Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is my third and final series on the war in Vietnam, titled, A Letter is a Living Voice. We will be reading letters and documented accounts written by Vietnam veterans. These letters show all the emotion of war, from fear to anger to love and fellowship. These are only the opinions of the writers of the documents and not those of the voice of Vashon or the readers. In addition, while some of the language in the documents may appear to be racially insensitive, it is the actual language of war. It is my opinion that to use the exact language to give the listener a true understanding of the veterans' ratings and their associated emotions is extremely important. In war, we demonize our enemy through our language and our pictures. We make them inanimate, therefore easier to kill. Well, here we are again for another episode, and I will be reading some of these accounts, and as we mentioned, they are some letters, some storytelling, and also Mike Suddeth has pulled these articles from the Beachcomber, and we appreciate that, and Susan Schreier is going to be our other reader. And I got her name right this time. I'm very proud of myself. So I would like to start out this is kind of a tribute to someone who lives here in Vashon or on Vashon. And it's an article from the Beachcomber, and it says, Silver Star awarded. And I think the Silver Star is the third highest second highest award that you can get. And it has to be under very certain circumstances. It has to be in combat. And this says, Captain David Weinkoff, due home in August, has received the Silver Star Medal and the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry for his performance during his current tour of duty in Vietnam. The Marine captain is the husband of Mrs. Wand Weinkoff and father of Mary, 5, Mark, 4, and Stephen, 21 months. And if you think about that, Stephen now is probably in his 50s. The family is staying with his parents, the John Carlsons of Portage. The Silver Star was for the action he performed February 22nd while participating in Operation Dewey Canyon, when he was commanding officer of Company H, 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, 3rd Marine Division. The awards said, Company H was assigned to establish an ambush along a major enemy infiltration route near the Laotian border. Skillfully maneuvering his company to the designated area, Captain Weinkoff rapidly deployed his men into well-concealed positions. Reconnaissance teams informed them that a North Vietnamese truck convoy was approaching his location, and he calmly waited, permitting single vehicles to pass his position. Then, as a large enemy convoy approached, he requested artillery fire on the road to the front and rear of the vehicles. When the enemy entered the killing zone, Captain Weinkoff initiated the ambush, boldly shouting words of encouragement to his men and directing their fire. He was instrumental in his Marines accounting for the complete destruction of 3 hostile trucks and 8 North Vietnamese soldiers, confirmed without sustaining a single casualty. Swiftly withdrawing his company from the area, he subsequently adjusted airstrikes and additional artillery fire against the hostile force, destroying 2 more enemy trucks. that morning. He conducted a thorough search of the area, which resulted in the capture of 222-millimeter guns with 320 rounds of ammunition, numerous anti-aircraft weapons, 10 trucks, 2 tracked vehicles, and 3 bulldozers. His bold initiative and resolute determination inspired all who observed him and contributed significantly to the accomplishments of his unit's mission. And so there you go. I think that that just, again, tells the kind of unique and dangerous and crazy circumstances they wound up finding themselves in those situations. And so now I'm going to ask Susan if she would read a letter.
I actually, Steve, have 2 letters from Don, and they were written...
Oh, good. Let's read them both.
June 23rd, 1970, and July 18th, 1970.
Oh, good.
The first one is, Dear Kathy, I just remembered your birthday is this month. I think it was on the 13th. I've been so busy, and my mind has been thinking of so many other things that I just forgot until right now. One of the other bad things, other than there being a war here, is that I'm in an area where there aren't any stores. In fact, I'm pretty lucky if I can even get a 7-Up or a Coke and a hot meal for myself. So what I'm going to do is put out an IOU on this letter, and when I get back to the rear area where there are stores, I'll try to find something really nice for you, and I'll send it to you then. You might not get it for a while, but I want you to know that I haven't forgotten, and I will send something. For right now, I'm going to send you a piece of the money that we use over here. It's quite a bit different than what you have, I'm sure. The paper dollar isn't that much different, but instead of having like dimes and nickels, they have paper change too. Pretty strange, huh? Well, I hope you like them. Maybe you'll want to show them to your friends. Anyway, I hope you had a really happy birthday, and I hope to be back next year for your next one. Love, Don. And then Don wrote to Joan just a few weeks later. Dear Joan, I guess it's been about a week since I've written, but it's really been a strange week, and I haven't had much time. We were called off of the landing zone duty July 10th because there was supposed to be some enemy nearby, so we stayed in that area for a few days. Then we were combat assaulted to another area where we took ground-to-air contact as we came down. We had 1 injured, and we killed 2, possibly 3, 2 women and a man. The next day, while I was writing a letter, we had another contact. The whole place lit up with machine gun fire and AK-47s. We didn't get anything, and neither did they, so that was cool. Yesterday, Delta Company 112 had 4 killed and 10 injured in the same area, and another company had 2 killed a few days before that. So we're really in a hot area right now. We're all hoping to get out of here as soon as possible. I got your birthday card and also the ones from Karen and Kathy. You don't have to get me anything, but like I said on the other letter, if you want to send some cookies, just from the bakery would be fine. Sometime in August, that would be so groovy. I sort of crave having some cookies every once in a while. Well, that's about all for now, just to let you know I'm okay. Thank you and the girls for the cards. They were really nice. Oh, yeah, and I also got one from your neighbor downstairs who really thinks a lot of you and the girls as I do. Hope everyone is fine, and I'll write more as soon as I get a chance. Love, Don.
Thanks, Susan. I'd like to read a couple of haikus that were written by Chris Gaynor. The first one is, we laugh. We always find stuff to laugh about anything, to stuff down the fear. Another one. This dance with death means we will never laugh so much once back in the world. Another one. What's so damn funny? Pranks we play on each other, black humor, fart jokes. You had to be there. Here's a series of just 3 little haikus on Hueys. And the Hueys were probably the mainstay of the war in Vietnam. One of my friends, his father is now almost 90, managed a group of about 100 helicopters, and just recently went in for some x-rays and found out he had shrapnel in his body that he didn't even know he had. He just thought he was cut on, and so that's kind of an experience. So Hueys were used for everything. They were used for medevac. They were used to drop troops primarily. A lot of times when they would drop troops, they would drop 8 troops. They also were able to fly low and fast and drop supplies. Hueys. So these are the haikus. They save our asses, but flying hot on them is white knuckle scary. Another. I hold on for life. Door guns on full tilt boogie. My boots hang in the space. And the last one. Our pilot balls out, skins rice paddies and treetops. We hover. I jump. Wow. Pretty heavy stuff.
Really?
Yeah. And I will read one little other story here, and then Susan can take over, and you can hear her nice voice. This is called a Vietnam drama, Grenade Removed. This is Saigon. A broiling hot noonday sun beat down on a group of doctors as they concentrated on their patient through tiny windows cut in a sandbag wall. Explosive Ordnance Disposable, EOD, personnel stood as the surgeon's elbow as he skillfully removed tissue from around the missile embedded in the wounded man's hip. Captain Ross Grelia, OED chief, is the son of Mr. and Mrs. Mark Grelia of Vashon. Far from outside the blast area, scores of other patients and medical men tensely waited and watched as the drama unfolded before them. At a signal from the doctors, an EOD team member moved from behind the shelter, gingerly removing and now protruding round from the wound and determining that no danger was present. The operation was over. When a Vietnamese patient was brought to Third Field Hospital in Saigon recently with a wound in his right hip, he was immediately rushed to the X-ray laboratory to determine the extent of the injuries. An object resembling an M79 grenade, undetonated, appeared on the negative taken, and hospital personnel sprang to action. After isolating the patient to protect others and calling the EOD team, construction of a sandbag bunker in the center of the hospital parking lot was begun. At 11 o'clock, 3 EOD men slowly and carefully wheeled the patient across the wide parking lot to the waiting medics. Captain Prentice E. Smith of Mississippi, the surgeon who volunteered to perform the operation, directed the placement of the wounded man so that he could begin his delicate work. At 11:05, the anesthesia was administered. Spectators behind barriers held their breath as Captain Smith, using a long-handled scalpel, began to carefully expose the round. At 11:25, a relieved EOD specialist displayed to the medical team a detonated artillery fuse several inches in diameter. The heroic doctors inside the recovery ward was an unidentified man with plenty to be thankful for. Well, I mean, you know, again, it's situations like this where what are the chances of having an undetonated grenade in your hip and even that not killing you? I mean, you've got a femoral artery in your hip, and I think there are just so many stories of, and I guess if you want to call them miracles, you can call them miracles or luck of the draw or whatever, but for this person, they turned out very well.
And the heroic actions of the surgeon who volunteered.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing is, that's the one thing that I think is so important is, so, you know, his chances probably weren't that good. I mean, basically, when you look at those type of grenades, they have a pin on them. And when you pull the pin, the part comes off and it hits hits your little trigger in there and it blows. And it's just, I can't imagine being in that situation. If you've ever seen the movie Hurt Locker, it's very much, like that. And the one thing that people either, you know, is interesting in the letter that Susan read about the bad officer that no one liked and was awful. You know, the stories that I hear from vets in Vietnam and from people like Gary Burka and Rick Adler, who basically saved each other in a battle, are still friends or closest of friends. And, you know, the vets have told me, you know, when you have the person on the left of you and the person on the right of you is the most important person in your life at that time. And those are friendships that, you know, never are the strongest and never change. So, Susan, do you want to do another one here?
Sure. I have a letter here that was printed in the Beachcomber, and it was written by PFC Larry Stair, S-T-A-I-R, and it was in the Beachcomber in July 28th of 1966, so it was obviously written shortly before then. I've been kind of bogged down in the mud of the monsoon season on a field problem. I'm about 15 miles from the Cambodian border near the villages of An Lok and Lok Hin. It's a pretty rough area. The last 2 weeks, we've had three very large battles in which we wiped out the 272nd Regiment of North Vietnam. We've killed over 1,000 and captured 400 more. I'm glad I'm in the artillery. I watch the infantrymen and armored units return after the battle, and it's hard to feel sorry for myself after that. Since I'm a surveyor, my job was completed before the battle even started. I listened to the whole battle on the radio. Our batteries fired over 2,000 rounds in the 3.5-hour battle and fired on the retreating Khmer all the way to the Cambodian border and maybe even beyond. I talked to an infantryman yesterday who aided that they were still finding bodies, who said, I'm sorry, that they were still finding bodies as conducted sweep operations. You should see some of these old French mansions around here. We're very close to a very large rubber plantation that were operated by wealthy French operatives. Some of these huge houses are really unbelievable. This is also the scene of many of the big French battles lost to big Ho Chi Minh many years ago. You see blown up French tank and truck bodies everywhere, just rusting in the rain and sunshine. I really got a kick out of Gay's drawings, especially the one of a soldier in a cage. I felt like it sometimes. And no, Gay, I don't like the Army.
Yes, maybe the Army isn't for everybody, but yeah. I guess you took it pretty serious when you were in Vietnam. Here are a couple, I'd like to do one anyhow. A little review of their time there in Vietnam. It says, I was 19 while in Nam. I was not married, but I went to high school with a girl and dated her before I went to Vietnam, and after coming home, married her. The dates I served in Vietnam were from July 14th, 1969 to July 13th, 1970. I was drafted. I was infantry. I was assigned to the American 11th Brigade. I served while in Nam by Duc Pho and San Juan Hill. I did one tour. I was a machine gunner during the first part of my tour, then became an RTO. I was wounded. You know what an RTO is?
No.
Okay. It's like education. We have all these acronyms. And I was wounded twice in the ambush the same day. I did basic training at Fort Lewis, Washington. I remember thinking, what will Nam be like? Will we be in a swamp or a jungle? Will it be hot? I soon got my answer up on arriving. They did this so we would have time to acclimate to the heat. They also assigned me to a wonderful job of burning human waste and KP. I had never been in heat like this, and I couldn't sleep or eat or poop. I remember while in KP, the cook and stirring soup with what resembled a small boat oar. And as he stirred the soup, I saw on the tip of his nose a bead of sweat. Yes, it was about to drip in the soup. I wasn't hungry. Anyway, after 2 weeks of that, I graduated to the next step. The field I was in, the field for about 3 days, I was beginning to get the feel of this. At least I thought so. It was my turn to go out on a sneaky. This meant we would send three of us out away from the company about 1,000 feet with a radio and a starlight scope. We would call situation reports in all night. That night, about 11 o'clock at night, the main company called us and said they were hearing enemy coming up the trail right towards us. They called in artillery and dropped grenades on them. We called the round firecracker rounds. They chased them into us. One of our tripwires went off, and the firing began. We laid as low as we could so we wouldn't be hit. Time passed, and things settled down. We called in to tell them we were okay and settled in for the night. Then we heard someone yell, "Chuhoy!" This meant somebody wanted to surrender because he was wounded. But no one is going to go help him because it could be a trick to get you to come out. And then we get shot. More time passed, and we called another report in, and then we began hearing breathing coming from just about 10 feet away. We grabbed the starlight scope, but could not get it to work. And I guess at that time you don't, take them to the repair shop or anything. We turned the radio off because we didn't want anyone to hear us. We sat there motionless until just before daylight, and then the breathing stopped. It got light enough to see, and our hearts are still pounding for fear when we realize it was a monkey that got wounded that night and finally died just 10 feet from us. The experience brought me a little closer to the realization of how precious life is. And this experience, things got a lot tougher, but so did I. We'll talk soon, Gary. And that was Gary Burka, who also received numerous awards for gallantry in battle. Do you have one more?
I've got a short one. I think we can fit the time in.
I think
in.
We can get a fit. Yeah, we can get a short one in, and then.
This is a letter to my mother. It's not signed. I don't know who it's from, but it's dated December 6th, 1967. I'm sorry I haven't written more, but I'm in kind of a stupor at this stage of the game and can't get my mind to concentrate on any one thing. We took some heavy casualties on this last operation. I feel I'm very lucky. My rig is riddled with bullet and shrapnel holes, and yet no one in my section was hurt. However, one of the crew from one of our gun batteries, Norm Goebel, was killed by an RPG. We were dug in and setting guard duty for the night and got some incoming mortar and rocket fire. It was coming in very near our position, and after a pretty heavy explosion, I heard someone yelling that they were hit. I made my dash for our medic, Corky Malass, which is becoming far too much of a routine for me, and we ran over to the location of the wounded. There were two troops on the ground, one with very grave injuries and a black soldier with some serious leg wounds who grabbed my hand and wouldn't let go. However, I managed to help the medic get him stable, and we worked on the more seriously wounded man. Unfortunately, the force of the blast severed his arm, and shrapnel pierced his body. We were unable to save him. The last words he spoke, "I know I'm dying. Help those other guys." I found out later that he was expected to rotate out of country pretty soon, and I'm not even sure why he was in the field that day, except that we are so undermanned.
Wow. Wow. That is just really kind of overwhelming, that kind of a letter. And
Steve, that it was a letter that he wrote to his mother. That touched me as a mom. I just can't imagine getting a letter like that.
Yeah, I mean, so many of these things, you know, now we are so close to war. And by that, I mean, you know, everybody in, and probably not everybody in Ukraine, but everybody in Ukraine has cell phones. Tiananmen Square, and they had cell phones. And we can all think of that one person holding up the flower in front of the Chinese tank coming towards him. But, you know, back then, in Vietnam, we got the news every night, and it was Walter Cronkite, you know, and he gave a pretty much a death report, how many troops killed. But to really get information that was so quick, you know, you had to, as a mother, as a father, as a brother, as a wife, a husband, you had to wait for a long time to get that information. You know, you didn't know what was happening. Now the troops, and you know, have got, if they're in a non-secure area or in a secure area, they can get Zoom. They can get, you know, FaceTime. They can see their kids. They can see their grandkids, you know.
And during Vietnam, a lot of families didn't speak for a year.
Right.
Unable to speak.
Yeah. And think again of Robert Barnett, who was in a prisoner of war camp for over 7 years. Mm-hmm. And his daughter was seven when he left, and his granddaughter lives on Vashon. Well, that's about it for this section. And it's very poignant, but I'm really enjoying this. And thank you much, Susan, for helping us out and doing all the transcribing. Goodbye.
Been listening to Is Abled with Dr. Stephen Nurse. This has been part 3 of his series on the war in Vietnam entitled A Letter is a Living Voice. To hear additional episodes, including his previous series on the Vietnam War, go to voiceofvashon.org and look for Is Abled under the Shows tab.